All right, so I guess we'll get started. My name is Ben Holland. I work for Rocky Mountain Institute in Boulder, Colorado. We're a 30-year-old nonprofit founded by Amory Lovins. We're focused mainly on building and implementing the business case for energy efficiency and renewable energy. And we do that in four sectors: the building sector, transportation, electricity, and industrial processes. So I work kind of at the intersection of electricity and transportation on an initiative called Project Get Ready. We started about 3 years ago with the goal to prepare communities and industry for the arrival of electric vehicles. So helping them understand really what the impact of the technology is, how to think about infrastructure, what are some of the implications for the grid, and how to work with, you know, your local utility to understand how best to integrate the technology. And we have about 25 city members on Project Get Ready and a number of strategic partners, and it's a bit of a network through which we're able to glean some insights into what works and doesn't work, and exchange lessons learned with all the stakeholders of the electric vehicle industry. So and that is obviously what I'll be talking about today. I'm going to talk about some of the things that I've seen in the last couple years. I may cover some familiar territory for you, so please let me know if this is tired information and I should move forward. So I'm going to first try something here. I want to get an idea of what kind of car you drive and how familiar you are with the technology. So we don't have to use this technology. I figured you all have phones out and computers, so it'd be pretty easy to do. So if you can tweet at poll, or tweet poll or text, or you can even go online. So I just want to know, you know, how many people in the room actually drive a plug-in vehicle. Full disclosure, I'm not one of them. And I don't know how the level of familiarity with the technology, but just to cover plug-in hybrid electric, just think the Chevy Bolt, although they would not like me saying that. They would rather me say a range extended vehicle. Think a pure electric vehicle with a backup gasoline engine. So something that can go 50 miles, and after 50 miles or less, it becomes your classic hybrid. Yeah.
Is there an option for like no car, like a bike?
Oh, I meant to put that on there. So raise your hand if you don't drive a car. Cool. All right. That's even better.
Can you talk with the microphone a little bit?
Oh, you can't hear me.
Yeah.
All right. Cool. Okay. So this is a Tesla Model X. It's a beautiful car, and I just wanted to. I think a lot of people are used to the notion of electric cars looking like golf carts, and we're in a different scenario today where, you know, most of these cars resemble your classic sedan. So on the outside, they're very similar to an internal combustion engine or classic gasoline-powered vehicle. This is an interior of a Chevy Volt. It actually has a backup gasoline generator. But, you know, the interior of these cars actually resembles more of a computer than it does your classic vehicle. So it's a significant shift in the design of vehicles and what they're capable of doing. There are challenges and there are also benefits. And for that reason, we actually are seeing a global movement to prepare for electric vehicles. And I want to cover that briefly. We have a number of initiatives. This is Stockholm, where cities around the world are preparing for the arrival of electric vehicles, putting charging stations in the ground, coming up with different incentives that will encourage the adoption of electric vehicles, you know, providing tax credits, free parking in downtown areas of the city, and really trying to leverage private enterprise to create sort of an EV-friendly ecosystem in these cities around the country. So, you know, why are they doing this? And particularly in the United States, there are many cities, including Austin and Houston. Houston's actually got a very concerted effort to invite the industry and encourage adoption of these vehicles. And a big reason is that at the beginning of his administration, President Obama announced a goal of having 1 million electric cars on the road by 2015. It's kind of a call to arms for the industry, and to help that, he injected about $2 billion through the stimulus to support the development of batteries, electric vehicles, and also the infrastructure needed to be in place. So on the surface, pretty audacious goal of a million cars, but you're talking about a drop in the bucket. So a million cars compared to our total fleet, about 250 million cars, less than 0.5%. And to give that extra context, I think many people in this room would consider the Toyota Prius, a mainstream vehicle. I think it was last April, actually, that they crossed the 1 million mark in the U.S. And so hybrids in general in the U.S. account for maybe 3% of total sales. So we talk a lot about the early adopter and how to move from the early adopter to early majority and mass adoption. So the question that we often ask at RMI is the Prius even a mainstream vehicle? Are we still in the early adopter phase? So in order for electric vehicle to achieve the things that we want it to achieve, significantly reducing our dependence on oil, reducing emissions, things of that nature, it's got to pretty much leapfrog the success of the hybrid. And that's one of the things we want to see happen, but there are many challenges in the way. So I'm just going to do a very brief history, and you'll notice I'm leaving some things out, but this is not a new technology. I think even before the turn of the 20th century, Thomas Edison and Henry Ford were collaborating. They were close friends and were collaborating to create an affordable electric vehicle. And Edison had his own manufacturing plant, and he was producing batteries for vehicles. And this is a very common refrain that we've heard, particularly since the 90s. You hear from automakers, next year we're coming out with an electric vehicle, or the year after that we're going to start producing 20,000 electric vehicles. So it's something we're used to, but there are a few things that got in the way. Namely, we discovered massive supply of oil at the turn of the century, and this picture is taken from South Beaumont, Texas. Spindletop is the name of the hill where they discovered this oil. And the oil was so cheap that for a week you could buy a gallon of it for less than you could buy a gallon of water. So it signaled the launch of a huge industry in the U.S. to develop our oil and also accelerated the demand for the internal combustion engine. So prior to this, you did have an internal combustion engine. You had an electric vehicle. An electric vehicle was actually favored because it was cleaner, it was quieter, it didn't smell of gasoline. Because if you think about the vehicles back then and how crude they were, the electric vehicle was kind of like the classier choice even. But this is a Model T, obviously. By the time the Model T was released in 1908, it was already sort of too late for the electric vehicle at that point. And from there, we developed, and I'm skipping things, obviously, but we developed a massive interstate system in leading to the development of these communities. You could easily move, obviously, from urban to rural environments in a matter of minutes. So it also negated the perceived need for rail. So what's the problem? This is obviously something that signals tremendous growth. It's a good thing for America. It built economies. We should be happy about that. It has negative consequences as well. And we first started to see those in World War II. And, it's interesting. This was like the first time, and really the only time, where Americans willingly curtailed their driving, because it was perceived to be a patriotic thing. And it was also the first time that we discovered that if we are to be a superpower, the U.S. is to be a superpower, access to energy and resources is imperative. so it was kind of at the tail end of the war that we locked in sort of our geopolitical entanglements that we're currently involved in right now. This is an interesting story. After FDR's famous meeting with Churchill and Stalin, he made a quick stop by the Suez Canal to meet the King of Saudi Arabia, where they met on a U.S. warship to pretty much solidify the relationships that we know today. Another negative consequence is that we have communities now that are fully dependent on cheap and abundant oil. You know, communities that simply would not exist without that, the access to that oil. And if that oil were to go away, it's reasonable to believe these communities would be abandoned. There are also very real economic costs. Since 1970, or from 1970 to 2008, the U.S. economy lost $5.5 trillion. In 2008 alone lost $600 billion. So the consequences of our dependence on oil are pretty obvious, and I'm probably preaching to the choir to an extent, and I apologize for that. So I'll move along to the electric vehicle. So we now have a situation where every major automaker in the world is planning to release an electric vehicle, at least within the next 2 to 3 years. And we're kind of on the cusp of something that may or may not be successful. And the big question is, you know, how is it possible to take this car and inject it into a system or plug it into a system that has been in place for over a century? How do we adapt the system that we have now to this vehicle? And, you know, what are the challenges ahead, and what are the incentives? So I'm going to do another poll, and I just want to get a sense of your interest in the vehicle and whether or not you would be willing to purchase one. So I'll just let this load. So for your next purchase, would you consider buying an electric vehicle?
I already have one.
There you go.
Yeah, how many?
Well, then you'll get another one, so say yes.
Actually, that's true. I will never buy another gasoline.
Yeah. Would you buy an extended range or a plug-in hybrid, or would it just be pure electric?
Never.
Yeah, I've been looking some leaf, and I would never do anything else anymore.
Right.
I would buy one with 300-mile range, you know, and Tesla.
Yeah.
Model S.
Yeah. I'm holding out for the Model X, and I need to get out of the nonprofit space before I do that. But so, okay, I'm gonna do one more. In your opinion, and you might disagree that there's something holding the plug-in back, but in your opinion, what is the biggest challenge for the electric vehicle? So is it the price? You know, I think a fair amount of people agree that the price of these vehicles tends to be high right now. Is it the range, or are you going to run out of power? Or is it this issue with the grid being, what are you powering the electric vehicle with? You know, if it's powered just with coal, is it really worth moving to vehicle electrification? Okay.
How many responses you get? Do you have?
No, I don't know what it is.
Like two people.
Yeah. That's fine. All right. So range. Well, I'm going to talk about price first. It's definitely the most obvious barrier for people. The cars are, they can carry anywhere of a $10,000, $20,000 premium, depending on which model and what you're comparing it to, which gets a little sticky. And I had mentioned earlier that this is something that we've been dealing with over a century. When Ford was considering producing a mass market electric vehicle, he didn't want to do it unless he could use Edison's batteries. And he had an exclusive deal with Edison, but Edison's batteries were far more expensive. So they had abandoned the project altogether. And there are also various conspiracy theories about why that happened. You know, Edison's battery plant caught on fire, I guess, in the early 1900s. And, you know, people think it was the early stages of big oil, but I don't know about that. So one of the things that has to be said about electric vehicles is the reduction in operational costs that you get. I mean, obviously, with a pure electric vehicle, you're not paying for fuel, period. You're not going to a gas station. You're not going to a service station to change your oil. With a plug-in hybrid, it's pretty similar as well. There are about a thousand less moving parts in an electric vehicle. This is something I particularly like because I do still drive a gasoline-powered vehicle. And for some reason, my mom continues to call me every 3 months to make sure that I'm changing my oil or checking my fluids because it's about a 12-year-old car. So for my next purchase, which will be an electric vehicle, I won't have to worry about that. And that's one less conversation I have to have with my mom. That sounds terrible. I love my mother, but that's not what I mean. I'll just address a question to you. What is perspective on the cost? I assume you got a tax credit, $7,500 federal tax credit for electric vehicles. I don't know if Texas has a state tax credit or not. Colorado has a $6,000 one.
Yeah. You know, it wasn't that bad. It was $25,000 when we were all down on the league.
Yeah.
2011. What's interesting is the price did go up for 2012.
Right.
That's demand driven right there.
Yeah.
Just on price alone. But if you price right your car, it's like a Camry, they're incredibly expensive. So it wasn't that much of a shock for us buying a new car.
Well, in Holland, the cars are about 50, 60, 70% more expensive anyway.
Right.
And you get a tax. We put less tax on the car, so it's not a tax credit, but we have less.
Sure.
70% tax on top of it, you only have 30% tax on it, and you don't have to drive it somewhere. So. I have one question. How much is a kilowatt hour here in America?
I think the average is 11 cents a kilowatt hour.
Oh, yeah. So it's 25 cents in Holland. So it's and still, it doesn't... I put things on the roof, sun on the roof, and I basically do 25,000 kilometers a year out of the sunroof of my house. And
wow.
Still, with these prices, it's very affordable to drive the electric car.
6.5 cents here in Austin.
Okay.
6.5 cents. It's unbelievable. What about four times
more? You know, so well, the current models have a 10-year warranty on the battery. It is one of the unknowns. But I had a conversation recently with a fleet manager in Colorado, and he was talking about hybrids, and similar questions come up about the Prius battery, and his perspective on the hybrid was very positive in that he had put, I think, close to 200,000 miles on the Prius without any negative impacts on the battery. So he thought that I guess bode well for the electric vehicle technology. But it is still an unknown. There are a number of studies out that say that after the useful life for a vehicle, a battery still has 70 to 80% useful life as a battery. So utilities can sort of bank them together for a variety of uses. They can be used as backup for houses or to capture solar energy and things of that nature. That's kind of the idea. What is undetermined right now is what the market will be for the second life applications of batteries. So I'll move on to infrastructure. This is another big issue, and I guess we found that range was the biggest concern for the people in this audience. So that is a very common sentiment regarding the vehicles, and that's for detractors of the technology as well as proponents. You know, this idea that you need an extensive charging network. And I think the opinion differs whether or not you're talking about a pure electric vehicle or a plug-in hybrid. But regardless, we are seeing through the Project at Ready network and other cities around the world all these efforts to put in charging stations. And it's the first thing that you really hear, because there are cities, and Austin's one of them, that wish to be kind of a leader in this space, and it may be mandated from the mayor even. So the most tangible and the easiest thing you can really do is put a few charging stations in the ground and say we're EV ready and throw a big rally, and that's what a lot of the cities do. In Portland, they have a street in Portland called Electric Avenue, and it's it's a block pretty much within Portland State University, and there are about 9 charging stations on the block. You had a question?
Yeah, I work for Portland State, and we just added the first battery system.
Right, yeah. So I assume you know George Beard.
Yeah.
He's a good guy. And there's also an effort, and the government's helped out with the deployment of charging stations as well. They're between 2 different initiatives, the EV Project and ChargePoint America, I think each together got about $400 million to deploy infrastructure in select markets. And those markets were closely aligned with the Nissan Leaf and the Chevy Bolt's initial rollouts. And I'm going to touch on that in a little bit, because they have actually collected data on the charging stations to see how they're being used, what time of day people are plugging in. You know, what you can draw some conclusions to see like how useful the infrastructure really is. So I'm going to do another poll. So the real question, I think, I guess I didn't clear the poll earlier. The real question, I think, is, that the cities need to ask is, how far are people driving? That's pretty easy to do. You can look at travel patterns and you can look at the density of certain areas to identify where charging infrastructure should go. Yeah, well, it's getting to be that here. The average driver, I think, travels about 30 miles a day. And even if you live a good distance from the city, and correct me if you disagree with this, but you're rarely driving over 40 miles a day, I think. Is there anybody in this room that drives 70 miles a day, 100 miles a day? Okay. Good. I think it's important to just point out the available technology or the cars that are available and how far they'll drive. It's funny, with a Chevy Bolt, you'll read a lot of articles or blogs that tend to be anti-electric vehicle blogs, and they basically share misleading information that the Volt only drives 40 miles. Certainly, that is pure electric, and then the gasoline generator kicks in to assist the battery. So it is a car that you can drive as your single vehicle, even if you are going 100 miles a day or more.
And the I can tell you that the Nissan Leaf statement, I have one that is such below
Well, it goes more like 60 or 70?
60.
Okay.
If you drive on the highway, 60 miles. If you drive 20 miles an hour inside the city, then you can do maybe 90 or 80. But I mean, if you normal drive 60, 70, 60 miles, and then you have to basically go to fast charging.
Do you use a lot of the fast charging stations?
Well, I do about 1,000 kilometers to 600 miles a week. So I need them,
yeah.
I use them between 5 and 10 times a week.
Okay.
They are essential. If you want to have a Nissan Leaf and have a normal drive, you need fast charging stations. They're extremely important.
Our Leaf group here is pretty stout, about 40 or 50 drivers. And we're all seeing about 80 to 90 miles. Now, that's in Austin with lots of hills.
Yeah.
We run the AC in the summertime, so that's 60 miles. There might be something up there. We really are getting 80 to 90 with the AC blasting. But I'll say, as an owner, the range isn't really the issue. It's been the biggest misnomer,
yeah,
I think, in the whole industry. It's purely the charge time.
Yeah.
So we only fear not running out of, battery. We fear, as an owner, how long it's going to take me to charge.
Yeah.
So with the advancements in quick charging, that's the holy grail. And that's where really all the infrastructure should be going, not necessarily extending the range. Because you're right, an average American drives about 30 miles a day on average. There's some folks that live rural, but for the masses, 30 to 40 mile range is really sufficient. That thing will get 100.
Yeah, with the charge time. The great thing about fast charging is it reduces the need for planning. And that's, I think, one of the setbacks for electric vehicles. You have to plan and know where you're going to be at this time of the day. And to plan for an 8 mile or 8 hour charge, maybe. I should probably just do a quick overview of the charging technology. So when we talk about fast charging, it's a direct current charge. In the U.S., it's not standardized yet. We're very close to it. Society of Automotive Engineers is responsible for creating this standard. There is one in Japan that's used pretty much everywhere but the United States. And the automakers are kind of battling it out to figure out what the standard should be. Nissan's already put the Japanese standard. It's called CHAdeMO. They've installed that in their cars. The charging stations you'll see, I think, here in Austin and in Portland, except for their new fast charger, the common charging station you'll see is a level 2. It's a 220-volt charging station. I can charge a car anywhere between like 4 and 6 hours, I think. And then, you know, at home, you will have either a level 2 or a level 1, which is just your classic outlet. So you had a question?
Well, I was going to say, in North Carolina, they're building up the infrastructure.
Yeah.
But they're putting in the level 2s. Then if you run low, you're not going to stand there for
four or five hours
to charge it back.
I mean, I think there are applications where that makes sense. Maybe at a workplace or, offices or... Or a hotel, you know? I mean, even a hotel, if you're staying more than 3 days, you can argue having level 110 outlet, you know, especially for a Chevy Volt. You know, the level 2 is it's unnecessary, I think.
I've seen them in the rest areas, and you're not going to be there at the rest area for a number of hours.
I'm not going to pull off the highway and hang out at a rest stop for for 4 hours.
We'll have maybe 100 owners in front of government officials just tell them. I mean, 100% consistent on this idea of stop putting in level 2s.
Yeah.
Just don't do it. Just stop. And they will not do it. They just won't make the shift.
So this is one of the things that we work on with Project Get Ready. And I think that we were actually responsible in the beginning for encouraging people to put in this infrastructure. And in the last year or so, we've pulled back and said, hey, you need to take a more of a conservative approach about this and at least understand what the locations are and what the use will be. I mean, you shouldn't put a level 2 station, something that's going to take 6 hours to charge a car, on a street corner. And the big reason why cities are doing this, I mentioned before, is because the only tangible way to really show that you're preparing for electric vehicles, and it's a bit of a branding thing as well.
Well, they will pick it up. I mean, now, we and I have 20 fast chargers in Holland. They're now, they've auctioned off all the parking lots along the highways, and we're going to, and there's about four parties who are basically going to put in 500 fast chargers in a little country, which is about, 10,000 square miles. So it's less than, it's about one, it's five, about 87% of Texas. We're going to have 500 fast chargers before next year.
Yeah,
and that's a commercial exercise. If people have decided to put it in, it's not government sponsored.
Yeah, the big reason for putting them in is also psychological. Most of our trips are pretty short. You can strategically place charging stations to account for to cover the typical driving patterns, but we're finding that a lot of the installations of charging stations are really to ease concerns or this idea of range anxiety. And when you're talking about infrastructure that's publicly funded, then it's difficult to make the argument that you should spend money on something that this was, appeases or assuages the concerns of people who have more money to buy an electric vehicle. And one of the things that we're finding, actually, is the data is coming out from Idaho National Labs, which manages the data for the EV project in ChargePoint America. And so they're pulling a number of data streams off of the charging stations as well as the cars. And we're finding that this is a number that may change over time, but we're finding by and large people are charging at home. And when they're only charging on average about once a day, and that's at home. So I think the other chunk is probably workplace charging. So it really begs the question, how much time should we spend on infrastructure as opposed to maybe improving the education and so the outreach helping explain the technology to people that may be interested in. That's one of the things that Portland's done really well, is they do have this block of charging stations. They hold events there, and it's kind of a visible indication of the city's efforts. But they've been able to align the utility, the city, and the university together for what is one of the best outreach and education efforts across the country. Raleigh, North Carolina is another one of them. They hold regular events, and they've done a great job at increasing awareness of the vehicles and explaining the technology to the people of Raleigh. So, yeah.
What percentage of the Americans have a driveway where you can basically charge your car yourself? Because in Germany, 80% has its own driveway. In Poland, 20% has its driveway, and you need, the most important thing we need for public things is charge at night. And 80% of the people will have to do that in the public space, and making municipalities aware of that and getting licensing accelerated, because normally you buy a car, it takes a long time before you have a parking lot somewhere near where you can park it. And so how is that here in, how is that working here in Austin? Did you get a parking lot, or do you have your own driving?
I think some of dense, you live in dense populated areas, so you got city type streets, you're parking on the street.
Yeah.
And of course in the US, we are fortunate to have such vast space, problems, especially like it is in Holland. But that's something to be aware of, when you park on the street, that's where you have to park. You're pretty much not a customer. You can't really get
it. Yeah.
Right now, that has pretty much the same thing. But when electric cars, I guess they're still coming out now, but it was all about the cities. I live in New York City. I like electric cars, but you can't find charging spots. Or the point is, that last pie chart you showed, does that also correspond with
You can actually drill down into the data. There's a, I think it's the advanced vehicle testing activity on Idaho National Labs site, and they have a report that goes down into Portland, Seattle, Knoxville, San Francisco, and it shows you the driving habits of all those cities.
It sounds very cool for cities to have these charging stations, but it really does seem that this is a technology that's perfect for, like, in the burbs.
It is Holland burbs or Austin burbs or the burbs are way out in front. It's at least 70% of the U.S. population. We like to think we all live in the city. We really don't. Cars. We live in suburbs, in apartments. Across the U.S. now. You're in New York, so...
You have a question?
Yeah, what's the most popular city
for EVs? In the U.S., it's definitely the Bay Area. San Francisco has a goal to be the EV capital of the U.S., and they're pretty close. And it's interesting, I was having this conversation last night, that San Francisco is another example where it's difficult to charge. I mean, you don't have a garage if you live in the city of San Francisco, so... they've had to find ways to set up public charging locations. And
I came in late, so did you already cover why San Fran is such a hotbed for this?
It's a combination of, I think, progressive populace and somewhat progressive utility. So, and it's also one of the early markets for Tesla, and also an early market for Nissan Leaf. And what happened was when they started the EV project through the government, they selected all these spots around the country and they talked to automakers about, where should we devote our resources. And so not only did they put charging stations in the ground there, they worked very closely with the utilities. So in California, Pacific Gas and Electric, San Diego Gas and Electric, and SoCal Edison, all three of them have pilot EV rate plans. So... if you buy an electric vehicle, they'll give you basically a time of use rate for your electric vehicle. So to incentivize you for charging off peak, I'm going to talk about that in a second, but I had another question.
Would it be a problem with IVs, people stole electricity from public areas of the government?
No, I mean, you have to do that, you have to run cables from some power source. You're not going to be able to do that unless you're working with the utility, or I assume you'll get arrested.
And it's you have to put it there for 8 hours. You know, it's not like for half an hour.
Yeah.
Well, one of the reasons why municipalities in Holland are really motivated is because of real hardcore self-interest. We have a pollution problem. And we have all kinds of standards we have to meet with the European European community. And so Amsterdam is one of the most polluted countries cities in the world. And they basically have made it. It's not because they want to motivate people to have a better world. They need less pollution in the city. So all the taxis have to be electric now. They motivate all the trucks have to be motivated. Is that in California the same way? Or don't they have a pollution problem there?
Oh, well, they have pretty strict emission standards and MPG standards there. I mean, they're really moving the industry, and I think it has to do with a sort of a progressive public. So, yeah. But you have a question?
Yeah, sorry, just a quick one. We were covering range anxiety, and we're moving on to the grid. I'm just curious how Google Maps and different apps out there, like car stations,
Yeah, so one of the great things that we're seeing is that there are a number of apps that come out where you can track your state of charge, how much, how full your battery is, essentially. You can get text messages when you need to charge. You can remotely identify where charging stations are, and I guess there are a couple models that can do this, and the future really is if you picture yourself driving through a city trying to find a parking space, or you have to access parking garages, you'd be able to remotely tell where the stations are and if somebody is plugged in. So it's kind of an added benefit. So you can find a parking space immediately. So that's fine. It's supposed to be 15 to 30 minutes to get an 80% charge.
How is to fill that tank, gas tank, would take maybe 2 minutes, 3 minutes max? With the car, you have to stay at the station for long. How, right now, because there is a few AVs, can be possible to do that. But in the future, if everyone have an AV, how can be that controlled?
So that is one of the issues that a lot of the cities we work with are dealing with. So especially for municipal parking lots or city parking managers, they're trying to figure out how to deal with that. I mean, you don't want somebody plugging into or taking a parking space for 8 hours because they want to encourage churn of those stations. And likewise, another problem is trying to enforce these parking spaces with charging stations to prevent internal or traditional vehicles from pulling in. And what happens when you start towing away pickup trucks for parking in front of a charging station, but those charging stations remain empty anyways. And what kind of public backlash will there be? And we've already seen the questions that get raised in different communities around the country about who funded this charging station that's been there empty. But I'm going to quickly go over the environmental component. This is something you hear all the time. Aren't you just replacing an oil well with a coal plant, and these cars are just as dirty as a traditional vehicle or a gasoline-powered vehicle.
Fox News,
yeah. I wasn't planning to really... I actually had a picture of Rush Limbaugh, too, and I wasn't really planning to take aim at all these people, but they just throw you these softballs. So if you live in Portland... obviously electricity is a mix. It's a generation of mix. It's not just coal. You have natural gas. You have nuclear, large hydro, and renewables. If you live in Portland, it's pretty obvious. The carbon impacts of electric vehicle are far less than an ICE. But what if you go to a place that's powered almost entirely by coal? Well, there is a place called Coal City, West Virginia, and it still beats out an internal combustion engine. And this is something that needs to be I guess, conventional wisdom at some point. That
are you talking clean or dirty coal, or are you making a distinction? Because the Eastern Seaboard, I mean, they got all kinds of old coal.
Yeah. Yeah, well, the numbers I've seen say it always beats an internal combustion. There are times when a hybrid, traditional hybrid, might have less of a carbon impact than an electric vehicle, but it's rare. One of the things that I wanted to note was that in the last 2 years, the U.S. has retired 100 coal plants. And, you know, I'll just go to my next slide. The electric car is the only car that gets cleaner with time, really, because the grid is cleaning. It's getting cleaned up. Coal plants are being retired because they're old or too dirty, and environmental regulations come into place that might make it too burdensome to run a coal plant anyways. So the utilities are swapping them out either for high-efficient natural gas plants, or they're not swapping them out at all because of they're using efficiency programs and things of that nature. And here in Texas is actually a really good example because I was reading the other day that last summer, during the heat wave, wind power played a big role in cutting the peak in the middle of the day. And if you think about all the air conditioners running in Texas last summer, as they will be this summer, and the demand that's placed on the grid, this is where renewables can actually come into play, because the price, the wholesale market price, is so high during those peak times, and you can bring in things like wind. So I'll get into a little bit about how you can use wind in a bit.
Important factor on that.
Yeah.
Because renewable wind, the key, it blows more at night.
Yeah. So
you really can't store electricity very efficiently. We know that with batteries. So the idea of charging EVs at night is just
it's perfect
benefit. We all plug in at night, the wind's blowing at night, and other sources.
There are times in Texas where the wind power delivered to the grid is more than the demand for energy at night. So you just basically have to spill that wind or just cut off the turbines. When you have electric vehicles in place, you can start thinking about using them as storage devices. And then long term, and there are already cities that are looking into this, delivering the power from your vehicles back to the grid, and maybe even making money on it, which will cut into sort of your overall lifetime cost of the vehicle. You have a question? Yeah. So there's something called the GREET model, and I'm not going to go into, I don't know, Nate, if you know anything about this, but there have been a number of studies looking at the life cycle cost of the manufacturing of the vehicle, or the batteries, transportation of the batteries, and sort of the rare earth metals that are needed. And there are instances where the production or manufacturing, or the energy that goes into manufacturing an electric vehicle is maybe a tick above internal combustion engine, but that energy is far offset by the fuel economy of the vehicles. So
in numbers for your average car, the operating energy footprint is 10 times that of the embodied energy and environmental footprint building a car.
Yeah, thank you.
The environmental footprint from operating the vehicle is 10 times that of producing the vehicle. So even if there's slight differences between an electric car and a gas car, it's outweighed enormously by the operating.
Is that like for an average vehicle lifespan, which is like 200,000 miles?
12,000 miles a year.
12,000 miles a year. And to reach that 10x, might you have to drive it for 10 years? So there needs to be like time.
Yeah, average lifespan of a vehicle in the U.S. is
9 years. Okay, thanks.
Question in the back? Shai Agassi. I don't have that in here, but I can talk about it. I'll get through this real quick. I want to just get through, and then I'll address that. But this issue of like increasing the electricity and this worry that you're going to break the grid, essentially. I'll just talk about a couple studies really quickly. EPRI put out a study that said, EPRI is the Electric Power Research Institute, put out a study that said that 1 million electric cars, or sorry, I This slide is actually incorrect. I apologize. 10 million electric cars will equal an increase in electricity needs or generation of 1%. And we're a long way away from 10 million electric vehicles, and we don't have 10 million hybrids here in the U.S., I don't think. And, you know, one of the big things, and we talked about this briefly, is this idea of adjusting your charge times to off-peak hours. So basically, this graph shows that currently the EV driving ramps up in the morning and at the end of the day. So noon is at the bottom. So you're driving to work. You're driving back from work. People, what we're seeing are people are charging right when they get back from work. So if we can move that charging into, if we can kind of rotate that charging into later in the night, there'll be excess capacity on the grid to handle it. So there's a study that came out, there are two studies that actually came out, another EPRI study as well as a Pacific Northwest National Labs study that said that you could pretty much electrify 70% of our existing fleet without adding a single generation unit if all cars were plugged in off-peak. I mean, you think about that amount of vehicles without having to add a generation unit, and it's pretty significant. And there's very good argument there that these are, you know, better for the grid or better for the environment as well. You had a question? So you can actually you can program any of these vehicles to charge at certain times of the night. Also, if you have a smart charging station, that'll do the same. And then there are a number of companies that are moving into the space, so startups. Like there's one in Boulder called Tendril. I think they're down here, and somebody from Tendril is speaking. But really help manage the charging of the vehicles and also just the use of your electric appliances in the house. And we're looking at, you hear the term smart grid a fair amount, and what it really entails is for most people it's a kind of a new relationship with your utility, and most people aren't used to, you know, receiving text messages or calls from their utility to say, okay, we've reached a point of critical peak on the grid, will you turn your air conditioner off? So there are a number of technology companies and software companies that are moving into the space. I think you'll see more of that here at South By in the next few years, and you're already starting to see it. There are a couple companies here like Simple Energy and Tendril and others that are moving into the space. So, and there are other utility incentives, like you'll be incentivized to plug in or charge it at the middle of the night, because like San Diego Gas and Electric is a good example. If you plug in on peak in the middle of the day or like right at 5 when people are getting home and firing up their air conditioners and turning the lights on, they'll charge you 36 cents a kilowatt hour. But if you move that charging to later in the night, they'll charge you 6 cents. So it's a pretty aggressive price differential for the time of use plan. So that's actually coming close to the end of my presentation. And I wanted to put this quote from Bill Ford, the show, to sort of after almost a century, we've still seen kind of fits and starts with this technology, and there are a fair amount of unknowns of where it's going to go. But I think we're certainly in a different period right now, and we're at a point that we've never been where we have all automakers offering electric vehicles, mass market electric vehicles in the next few years. So I want to do one more poll because I'm just interested. And I'll talk a little bit about the Better Place model that you asked about, Shia Gassi. I just want to know if you, based on some of the things you know about electric vehicles, some of the things that we talked about, is there kind of a business opportunity, some of those things that, you know, software companies coming in or programmers working with utilities, interesting ways to give feedback to customers and drivers about their driving patterns and their behavior, you know, being able to sort of provide data to people using these cars. So I'll talk a little bit, since we have a couple minutes left, I'll talk about this Better Place model. And Israel is the sort of the launch location for this company called Better Place. And it was founded by Shia Gassi. And their strategy is to do battery swapping. So instead of being reliant on a public charging infrastructure, you can pull into what looks like a service station, basically. You drive up, they swap out the battery. And it's supposed to take about 3 minutes to do that. Problem is that these stations cost a couple million dollars to build. I believe that you have to, they store the batteries below the station, so you have to keep them cooled for when drivers come up. There is a pilot program in San Francisco that they're launching, or they already have, or they will in the next couple months. It is a really, really cool business model. The problem, though, right now is that by and large, the automakers that are producing electric vehicles are not building them to be compatible with the Better Place model. Tesla has a Better Place optional model for the Model S and the Model X, I think. So, are there any other questions?
Comment on that a little bit. The gentleman said the batteries, how long they last in 10 years, are we worried what will happen, right? But the battery technology, you can really thank the cell phone industry and the laptop computer industry for the existence of these EVs, which I find is kind of peculiar. It's not the automakers, it wasn't the old companies, for sure. It was the battery manufacturers. But the advances are pretty stout right now. IBM has entered the game, you mentioned the business, and they have a technology that they're testing called lithium air.
Right.
They're seeing that's a little unstable, they're working on it, but within 10 years, that's a long time in tech. And they're already talking 500-mile range, but the physicists working on it, it's a staggering. They see theoretical ranges of 1,000 to 10,000 mile range.
Yeah.
It's game over at that point.
There are other advancements just in the price of the battery. So the price of a battery pack varies tremendously, and automakers are kind of quiet about how much they're actually spending because they don't want you to know if they're actually losing money on their cars. And really, to get the price down, it comes down to economies of scale. But I think we're hovering anywhere from between $500 to $1,000 per kilowatt hour for a battery.
No, the Nissan Leaf was $375.
That's what
Tesla is now at $250. And when I first wanted to buy my car, it was $800 per kilowatt hour. But Nissan came out and says it's $375. And Tesla did in the last column when they were.
They said, you know, Elon Musk, I think, said that.
They were $250 for the cell on the cell basis.
Okay. I think for the whole battery pack, Elon Musk said that $250 per kilowatt hour is in the near future. There's a company that just 2 weeks ago announced that they hit, I think, $125 per kilowatt hour. They're called Envia. And, you know, they're in research phase right now, so things change when it goes to market. But if you can hit that mark, which I think it's reasonable we can, especially if demand increases, for $150 per kilowatt hour, that's a bit of a game changer. And that's when you're talking about these vehicles really being competitive on a price point with traditional gas-powered vehicles. Yeah. Yeah, so I guess the bulk of the lithium deposit we have some in the U.S. A lot of it's in Bolivia, and then we just found some in Afghanistan. So, you know, we're fine. But no,
right. You know, if any country needed a natural resource, that's the one, right?
Yeah. So the general consensus is that supply of lithium ion is not an issue. Some people have raised concerns about other rare earth metals like neodymium, and the fact that the bulk of that supply is owned by China, and so there are concerns about, you know, China playing with the prices of that metal. So
also in Germany, DBM is doing exotic battery technology, and it's capacitor based, not lithium.
Okay.
It's pretty cool. And the brilliant thing about it that they're advertising, they did a test in October. They drove from Berlin to Munich. Audi with DBM. 300-mile range.
But
the kicker was it was a 6-minute charge.
Wow.
On that battery. 6-minute charge on that battery. And it says capacitor can have that.
Yep.
We're all wondering how they're doing it. They're tight, obviously, it's patent and all, but that's going to hit in 2013.
You have a question? Yeah.
Interaction between your transmission and how you know that something's wrong
Well, I'll let some of the EV owners speak up.
This is the best car ever. Super quiet, which you love. I mean, it's enough for everyone that
wants a gas car or
download a ring for
your car. Yeah. I think that'd be solving a muscle car, a high-five car.
It's kind of scary.
It actually exists. There's a company a few years ago in Brabus, a tuning company in Germany. They built an electric car, and you could program a Ferrari engine.
It'll zip by.
They're faster than any ICE engine out there.
Well, I understand that, but you know, there's still an emotional connection to a gas powered car that you cannot.
Oh yes, we can.
I guess like the car. Hey, look, I'm not a car guy. I don't own a Honda Civic, and I live in San Francisco. I don't own a Prius.
I'm a car guy. I race, and I get his point. But I mean,
well, the association with the blind is pushing for electrics to make.
Well, I wonder, yeah. Are they doing anything about that?
I mean, it's just you're talking about a different emotional connection. There'll always be those people. I mean, they're not going anywhere. The people that have muscle cars, people that build their own vehicles, and I think it's fine. I mean, but I still think that's a segment of people.
It's tiny.
And that's okay. But I think by and large, you know, the average person that drives a car just has something that's going to get them from one location to the next.
You brought apps and like Google Maps, EV charging station locators. I've used a few, and for the EV owners here, one sent me to like a private residence. It said it was just a charging station, okay. One sent me to a business that had it only for their fleet vehicles, and another in New York sent me to a lot, which Bloomberg, Mayor Bloomberg, had opened just a few weeks before. This is great. Oh, it's wonderful. Yeah, it's cool, and I charge, but I also pay $45 because it's normal parking. So is this filling up with gas. Have you guys, any other EV owners, had similar problems, dilemmas with apps and that?
So the interesting thing is the government in certain locations around our country maps out charging stations, and sometimes it's private, like ChargePoint or whatever. I actually planted that comment. I founded carstations.com. It's like an open source wiki where people can say, oh, this charge station is down. Like, don't do it. And then you can check in and stuff. So it's trying to alleviate some of those issues, but they definitely exist. You know, it can be expensive, and then someone's already there, they didn't check in.
That's the biggest part. Going to a charge point and someone's there, you don't know that people are going there. That's what the apps really need help with. And they don't do that right now, not in the league.
Right. Well, in Holland now, we have about 4,000 public things, and you can see if they're available. So you can see if somebody's there.
Yeah.
Not for the fast charges, but for the slow charges. And that's what you need, because free parking spots. But technology will say, well, that will be sold. I mean, like initiatives of yours, and everybody does that in every country. And but when we're now doing thousands of cars. I mean, I saw that the Volt was only sold 10,000 times here in this country. And in the Netherlands, they sold 4,000 copies. You know, it's a 20 times smaller country. We're not anywhere near the million or 2 million or 3 or 4 million. It's unbelievable how small it is here. I'm just really shocked that the United States is a lot less developed than Europe.
I think that, you know, with time, it comes down to also more options. Well, I mean, well,
Chevron's here, made two
vehicles. Yeah.
ExxonMobil.
Yeah.
But you know what? One last time, and I'll shut up. What the industry, I'll stand for this, what the industry isn't really saying is the idea that it's 2.5 cents, listen, Austin, 2.5 cents a mile. And I think it's important for the consumer, the layperson. You've got to say it in those terms. It's 2.5 cents a mile versus 14, 16, we're going to hit $4.
It's 5 times cheaper.
Yeah, or monthly fuel cost is another popular term. So monthly fuel costs, like on a monthly basis, you're
watch it. It's $18 in my house.
$18 for me last month.
40, 50. We fill up to Camry, and it's so that message is just not getting through.
Yeah.
So this cost per mile, or however you want to spend it with the marketing post, needs to happen. Or it's just going to be a slow road.
Yeah, I mean, I think the automakers need to get better at advertising these vehicles and getting a clear sort of consistent message across, and I think that they're actually planning to do that. There's an organization, sort of trade or industry association for electric vehicles, and they're going to launch a national education campaign.
Another, just a quick comment. I appreciate your thoughts on like the gasoline thing. You know, gets heated because I think we all want to see more EVs on the road, and I mean, I care about the environment. I also really like video games. I play Forza 4, and like the lead into that game was really cool. They've got the Top Gear guys, and they're like, "There's a place for us now, like, racing these high octane vehicles." And it was really cool. It was like fun, and you can still enjoy that, but it's like in a video game context, and set it out in real life. I just think that was really different than the marketing of that.
Just first question again about the batteries. I think it, taking an example, the cars that cost the white ones, then the market is always getting more powerful, both more processors, more graphics, etc. And the problem about everything is the battery. Is always fighting about batteries for everyone. Apple recently is attending something like a hydrogen battery for a fuel tank. It's perfect fuel tank for. And my question is: it's not buying an IV right now. It's not like buying a Nokia cell phone. No features at all because the technology is not advanced because of the battery of the car.
Right, so the question is, should you wait for the technology to advance?
Sorry, again, 2 cents of just all you have to ask yourself, do you want to pay 5 cents, 15 cents a mile, or 2 cents? That's really your only question for a consumer. If you have to buy your gasoline, I'll never do it, ever.
Yeah, but right now people is buying iPhones. A phone that I know that it not last one day with battery without being recharging. But you still buy an iPhone because I like the iPhone. So in a car, I can afford that. Okay, I know my car is not getting longer than middle of the day. I need to recharge twice a day my car because I need a car. And I can do that with a car because it's not affordable. With a phone, I can do that. I can have, right now I have my charger here. I can get the volume. And recharge is easy because it's in my pocket. A car, I can get the car inside a building because I have no way to recharge in the street. It's different, the concept, but I think it's the same because it's everything working with batteries. With gas, okay, you know, you have a tank, you have more gas available, and it's easy to get the fuel because you take minutes to recharge.
So you still have fear. You still have an anxiety, what you're saying, of this idea that you're going to be stuck.
Exactly. That's the problem. Because this is what currently happened. I need to disconnect everything as well, the Wi-Fi and everything, because I only need GSM to make that important call. In a car, you can't.
The only thing I say to that is, I had that same fear. My wife and I, we had 2 cars, so we were protecting ourselves. And I kept waiting for this fear to manifest itself, to really get stuck somewhere, and it's never happened. That's what I'm trying to say. It's never happened. Now, I'm driving in Austin. I go everywhere. Go up to Round Rock, go up to the airport. It's the 100-mile range, and you don't bust that. I would say on the worst day, if I'm really trying to do a lot of shopping, kids soccer, movie at night, you'll get close. And with Teslas, it really is. They hit the magic number. The 200-mile range is almost the speed. You really can't exceed that as a consumer in any city. You just can't.
I'll rent a car for vacation.
But if you're going to drive, yeah. And then we also heard from younger folks who said, well, I can't buy an EV because it will be the only car I've got. And now a lot of these young folks who tell me this, they said, well, what turned out was they have so many friends that are lined up to borrow their EV, they'll easily, happily loan them their gas car. So for a while, it's been really good with the whole single car. Because I thought single car people would not buy it, but even that's becoming a trickle. So these fears and things just really...
That's what I do. I have 5 neighbors who would love to have my car for a day, and we switch cars.
What government level in the U.S. Will do the infrastructure thing? I mean, it's not national, that's for sure. Is it city? Is it state? Is it where?
Are you asking who's funding it?
Yeah, who's funding
it? I mean, it was federal government. I mean, they did put money into... the deployment of infrastructure. I think the president announced 2 weeks ago, sort of returning to that commitment and providing even more money. And they also used to provide a tax credit for the infrastructure too. So it is partly federally funded. That is going away, and now it is sort of state grants that we're seeing.
Can you comment on the EVSE, the plug that got modified for Nissan Leaf cars? Because that was cool. That was non-government.
You mean, are you talking about the charge port? Or?
Okay, so every Nissan Leaf owner gets a 110 charge port, so they can plug into any outlet, in any home, in any business. Some engineer who's a Leaf owner in California took that 110 plug and changed the interior of the components to this thing and made an adapter so it could plug into a regular 220. Now, regular 220 outlets are in 95% of the homes in America.
Okay, but the car has no site to the policy.
I know.
It's
the homeowners. That right there was a consumer did that, and that almost made every house,
yeah,
almost every house in America.
By a room,
yes.
The Leaf recharges so well on the brakes that if you fill a Leaf for about 10 minutes and you just kind of tap the brakes, it keeps regenerating itself so you can go another 20, 30 miles.
Yeah.
I mean, miss, I won't like it, but at least you can help yourself.
Thank you.
Yeah. That was fun.